I'm very lucky in higher ed. Through my 20-some years experience teaching in higher education, I specialize in one course, that is school in American society. That look at school, how our school is an inseparable part of our society and how our society impacts our school and shape our school. So glad that you can come to this seminar and workshops. This is basically Asian American Asian Research Institute's director, Joyce Moyes' vision. We did a kind of a self-study of CUNY about 2 years ago about Asian faculty and its leadership role or leadership positions in CUNY. And unfortunately, we're very disappointed by that report, even though the school, CUNY, have fully supported us and gave us all the data. But the data is horrifying because there are hardly any representation of Asian in that leadership positions in all 24 campuses. So this is one of the actions that we take to nurture future pipeline of minority women into leadership positions in the city and also in CUNY system. So today you are recommended by your dean, your department chair, and even president to come to this. So it's a privilege, but I hope this opportunity could be extended further in the future for many, many of women that have potential to become leaders in our community. And in the city particularly, I think we see the women representation politically eroding, I think, through this, even though we won local election this time, but we see the council members and, well, we, you know, we're not doing very well as a women as a group. So this is a great vision for today's workshop. And I hope that through building a community, the way we, my mentors is always a great asset for my career and also for my life. And the way is, as we grow, we face someone, and then through the moment of meeting someone, you are able to articulate and present yourself to the fullest. So every person is a huge book, but you have to imagine, you know, when you face up to someone, walk to someone, you open a page that represents you. And what would you want that to impress, to kind of elaborate, and also to tell what you are really is, okay? So therefore, today, we have this encounter of a future kind of a going into the future vision, and I hope that not just among yourself you know each other across campus, but also you build relationship with the panelists that we select for you. You build relationship with Ari that have this great vision to create women's leadership in CUNY first and then in the city. And then with that, I'm going to introduce Joyce Moore. Okay.
Thank you very much, Carol. Again, as Carol said, you were among the selected few. There was something about you that stood out to your presidents, your deans, your provosts, your department chairs. Understand that that means that you have made that impression on that page that you opened when you met faculty and other members of the CUNY community. So we're hoping that you're going to hear from our leading women, because we want you to become leading women. We want your voices at the table. We want your perspectives at the table. We need your perspectives at the table, because you know what's going on in the world. Can you imagine artificial intelligence and other things being developed without our input? Every single machine will be acting like a god. Good Lord. What we need to do is make sure that our voices are at the table at every important discussion, when we're talking about the education, the future of our families and our children and ourselves, when we're talking about the policies in terms of where the funds are allocated, where do our tax dollars go? Does it go on a rocket ship that kills people? Or does it go into our schools? Does it build our communities and the playgrounds? Does it lift people out of poverty? We need to be answering those questions. We have to be at the table. So again, please engage. Get to know one another. You're building the future. We're trying to create networks for you. Many of the panelists are either first-generation college attendees. They may be immigrants or children of immigrants, as I am. And I wish I had these opportunities, and that's what brings us here today, to try to provide resources, new perspectives for you. So please, please take advantage of that. And so with this, I'm going to turn it over to our moderator, Lily Tang. She'll tell you a little bit about herself, and then we will move on to the panelists. Thank you all so much. It's really great to have you.
Before we get started, I was listening to Carol and to Joyce, and I really would like you to give yourselves a round of applause. Congratulations for being selected to be here. Congratulations for getting up this morning to be here. I know we have a very distinguished panel, but I have to say, from a personal perspective, we don't always get such a distinguished audience. So thank you very much. We have a lot of ground to cover today, and we have some very distinguished speakers that are going to be sharing not only their expertise, what they've learned, but also what they've experienced in their lives as women, as professionals, and as leaders. I'll start off by just kind of connecting with you a little bit. My name is Lily Tang. That is my maiden name. I just never felt like his mother, Mrs. Lang, so I kind of kept my maiden name. Even in a time where it wasn't really such a widely accepted thing to do. So today, I feel like I'm in the groove, right? I've had sort of an interesting career path. I don't even know if you would call it a path. It's a river and a bunch of tributaries. I started in psychology. My family is come from a long line of academics, and so it didn't matter what you got your PhD in as long as you got one. So I got one in psychology because I kind of liked people, and I wanted to know how they worked. Then I sort of got married, and I fell off the tenure track to join the mommy track, and raise two daughters. I was a stay-at-home mom for about 12 years. And so, you know, staying at home, being a mom, is a little bit isolating. So I would invent things to do, like move the furniture around, you know, join different organizations in my neighborhood. And I kind of fell into this opportunity to cover local politics for a local newspaper. So I became a freelance journalist, and then I became a full-fledged journalist with the Forbes organization. Then I kind of fell off of that track because my family's business was growing and kind of needed someone with an MBA, and I had gotten my MBA when I was at Forbes, and I could speak the lingo and that sort of thing. So we developed a international business. I went to China, and I spent a few years there. Then China took over Hong Kong, and this was 1997, and a lot of the intellectual property, a lot of the wealth, a lot of people who were concerned about their futures left China, left Hong Kong, came back to the United States. So we kind of packed up and came back to the United States as well. So I'm telling you all this because there were intervals in my career in which I really didn't know what I was doing. Came back to the United States and I said, look, I have a PhD, an MBA, and a CEO is after my name. What do I do? So I sent out about 1,000 resumes and didn't get any response because I didn't know what I was doing. I really had no clue how to get a job. So I fell into another job. My daughter was dating this guy. His mother was the principal for a very large human resource firm, and she was building an international practice for diversity and inclusion. And so she said, "You've got a great background, why don't you come work for me?" Well, over the next few years, I spent traveling and have worked in 6 continents doing diversity, inclusion, leadership work, very focused on women. And then a few years ago, I had an opportunity to do a research project. And maybe some of you have heard about it. I know Joyce has encouraged me to talk about it. We started the Everest Project, and we published a research paper last year called Women, called The Eve of Change, Women Redefining Corporate America. And it's been very, very well received. Over the past year, I've been traveling and talking about our research, and I've immersed myself in another research. I've become part of the International Council of Psychologists, and we are working on a research project to be released next year. So why research? It's data, number one. But it's also information in which you can turn into insights. It's information that you can use, not only on a personal level, but on a professional level, on a societal level, on a global level. So that's why I think research is important. I'm not a data geek. I'm mostly around narratives and the stories that we share. So we'll probably have an opportunity to interject some of that over the next couple of hours that we are spending together. Thank you very much for being here. I'd like to take this opportunity to have our panelists. I could do it, but I'd probably do a poor job of it. So I'm going to ask each of the panelists to introduce themselves and get to know you. Let's start with Aylin.
So my name is Aylin Hu, and I'm currently the President and Chief Operating Officer of a nonprofit organization called the Opportunity Network. We have been around for about 14 years, and I joined the organization about 7 years ago when our budget was a little bit under $1 million, and there was 5 of us. And today there are 30 of us, and our budget is $5.6 million. And so that, I say that just to kind of show you the amount of growth that we've experienced over the past few years and all the changes that came. And in those 7 years, I also had 2 baby girls. And so, you know, a lot of growth all around. My background started, it was always firmly anchored in social justice work. I think as somebody whose family moved here from Taiwan when I was 11, and moved to a predominantly white town in New Jersey, there were experiences that I had that led me to believe there has to be a better way to move through life, right? And so that really influenced my passion and my commitment into social justice work. And so, you know, I'm type A, super type A, in the sense that I thought I knew what I wanted very early on. I was like, I'm going to be an attorney. This is what I'm going to do, right? I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be a public defender. This is how I'm going to define my life purpose. And then you learn. And you learn about yourself. And you learn about the field. And you learn about your assets and your strengths. And things change, right? Things change. And so I would say a few of my earlier jobs in my career, being an executive assistant to a VP of a foundation, doing all the grunt work, but learning from all of the grunt work, and then realizing I'm really good at it. I'm really, really good at it, right? And so that really developed my passion for management. So you fast forward that kind of a few ways down in terms of my career, and worked with really amazing, amazing social justice organizations and research institutions to apply my skill sets, kind of align my passion for social justice work and also my strengths in management. And so that's a little bit about me.
Hi, I'm Myra. I think this is, I just wanted to comment on the format of what this day looks like, and the fact that all of you are sitting here. It's not just an open forum, hey, women, come on, let's get together. It's really an opportunity to highlight you guys, and that's meaningful to me because, you know, there's so many young people who really want you to take advantage. I don't usually do a lot of these because I said, to be a panelist, you really need to kind of, like, know what you're talking about. And I always get really nervous, so depending on the topic, but this topic I'm very passionate about, which is women and supporting women. And I'm like, I have plenty to say in this department, and I'm here because of you, so thank you for having time for me. I never know how to sum up what you do, right? Because life is a road and a book, and there's plenty of chapters, and you know, how do I? So I'm just going to do like just the headlines of my chapters, and then we can get into it, so I don't take too much time. But New Yorker, born and raised, you know, Washington Heights, Dominican, Puerto Rican. My father came from the Dominican Republic, my mom, first generation Puerto Rican, and was raised in civic engagement, community engagement in a very heavy way. At 15, I was somebody knocking on doors, petitioning, not allowed to petition, but my parents were like, it's okay, just knock on the door, you talk, and then my mom, if somebody was ready to sign, would come and just hold my clipboard. Because then that meant, you know, like officially she's touching it, so literally signing for my mom, not for me. But they had this 15-year-old knock on the door, hi, my name is Mara, you know, I'm collecting signatures for the Democratic Party, can you sign? My dad was running for something for my dad, please. You know, so it really worked for them, and they just, you know, had me go all over the place. But that was the opening to what this political and community engagement was. At 18, I ran for community county committee. At 21, I ran for district leader, which is a local party position. But you know, you have to like collect signatures for yourself. And I had like little posters around, and I was on a ballot, and I represented like 100 blocks. You know, so it was nice. I did that for 10 years. I wanted to go to law school. And I wanted to, I did all types of internships, and life took me elsewhere, which I'll share later. But I ended up working at World Vision, which is a nonprofit organization around the world for child sponsorship. Usually at like 3 a.m. you see those commercials. I used to work for them. Did that for a little bit, and I was an executive assistant, and I was able to kind of grow and get three other positions. And I started my own consulting company, and I worked for Con Edison, so then I had to learn how to make blueprints, and that was really fun. Then I went to the executive chamber, I worked for the governor, I did Latino affairs for New York State, and I did that for 4 years. In between, I ran for office again for assembly. I lost by 612 votes, but it was like an amazing experience. I learned so much about my community and much, much more about myself and how far you can kind of push yourself. I went back to the chamber. Now I work for Coca-Cola. I do community and government relations. I do public affairs and communications, and I cover New York and Puerto Rico. So that's something. Oh, and I'm a mom of three.
Okay, so how do I define my life? Totally clueless about everything. But whenever I got to do something, I did it well. But honestly, I came to the United States 46 years ago from Colombia, South America. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. All I knew is that I didn't want to go back to get married and have kids at the time. You know, talking about a long time ago. I came to the U.S., I fell in love with New York. A lot of us do that. Fall in love, and you know what it is, falling in love. You fall in love, and then you don't know what you're doing. I stayed, I learned English, I went to high school, and then I was homeless for a while. I slept on the train number 7, not fun at all. It wasn't a long time. I drove a yellow cab in New York City for about 10 years when I was very young. It was probably 3 women at the time driving yellow cabs. And I love that job.
I know I met you years ago.
We used to drive from 4 p.m. to about 4 a.m. And I tell you, I will make sure that all my friends knew that we worked from 4 p.m. until 1 a.m. And then it was dancing time. There were so many clubs to dance in New York City in the early late 70s, early 80s. It was great, and I was such a good dancer. So I enjoyed what I did. I really did. And then, you know, I always wanted to go to school, but I could never. I had no papers. I was undocumented. My parents and my entire family, I have 9 brothers, they stayed back home. My father was an accountant, was able to provide for them, and they just couldn't understand why I wanted to stay here and suffer so much. But I just wanted to do it, but I just didn't know how. So after the 10 years of the cab driver, I finally got a job with the government. Once I resolved my situation with immigration, and I got a job with the post office. So if you survive being a cab driver for 10 years, and then you survive being in the post office, you can survive anything. I always wanted to go back to school, but I got to tell you, the first time that I tried, they kicked me out because I was working and going to school. It was impossible. And then the second time, I really did it well. I studied one class a semester. Because no matter what happens while you're trying to achieve a degree, even if you get derailed for whatever, sickness in the family, children, I mean, I don't know, whatever. But always keeping that dream about wanting to go back to school is the key, because I think I always had it. So I finally was able to get to Queens College when I was about 31. And, oh, I had a great time at school. I was working, I was going to school, I did very well. I think about a year before I graduated from Queens College, it took me about 6 years to get my BA in English Lit, because I really wanted to learn how to write, read, you know, express myself well. So somebody told me, English Lit, that's what you do. You learn to read, you learn to write, so that's what I did. And about a year before I graduated, I went to a school, what do you call it, school mentor? Or whatever.
Advisor.
I don't think we call it advisor at the time, but, and I said, you know, I wanted to go to law school. And he looked at me and he said, you're kidding. Why do American kids want to go to law school and they don't get accepted? You want to go to law school? No, no. Become a paralegal, become a secretary, become anything, but law school is not for you. I walk out of there and I said, I'm going to law school. I really didn't know how hard it was going to be. It was like another language. I mean, here I was, you know, what did I know? Driving a yellow cab, working for the post office. What kind of English do you achieve? I mean, it's not very sophisticated, right? And so I went to law school. I made it. I passed the bar as soon as I took it. I was so surprised. I was like, whoa. And I said to myself, how am I going to get a job? I had all the things against me. I was Hispanic. I was a woman. I was a lesbian. I was Colombian. And I was 44. I said, who's going to hire me? And you know, somebody said, you know what you do? Go to as many interviews as you can. And don't get discouraged, because the more interviews you go to, the better you learn to answer. You know, the sooner you're able to answer. So that's what I did in the beginning. That was horrible. I mean, I don't know how people listen to me. You know? But I gotta tell you, when I passed the bar, when I finally got admitted as a lawyer, I got three firm offers. From one police plaza, from a not-for-profit across the river, Staten Island, and National Labor Relations Board. And I go like, wow. And I asked one police plaza, what am I going to do there? And they said, you will be arresting prostitutes. I go like, I don't want that job. And they offered good benefits. It was a steady job. That's what my mom told me. She says, take that job, honey. You have worked very hard in your life. You need a 9-to-5 job Monday to Friday. And you know, I bump into this guy who told me, Mercedes, what do you want to do, really? I said, well, I want to go back to my community. But I don't know how, because I've been away from my community for such a long time, going to college, working, going to law school, preparing for the bar. I mean, my community, I only went there to eat rice and beans. That's about it. And I live in Fresh Meadow, where most of the Asian population was. So I said, yeah, I want to go back to my community. And he says, well, don't you write a grant? I said, what is that? You know, I remember that. When I went to school, we didn't have internet. But when I went to law school, it was in its very beginning. Write a grant. I said, for what? To go back to your community. I said, really? So I look it up, you know, we didn't have some internet at the time in 1999, and I found a couple of grants and I wrote one. I began, and everybody called me. But I did it well, and they called me. Yale University. I had never seen such a beautiful school in my life. And the auditorium there, Jesus, I was like, this is incredible. And I got it, I got that grant. And I went back into my community. And I created an Apple project. We saw about 1,700 families in which I guide them. We try to help them. I had a group of attorneys from my school, CUNY. We had a group of about 300 attorneys. And my friend introduced me to them and said, look, she just created an Apple project. She's supposed to be seeing people and she doesn't know anything. So they all go, we help you. And it was incredible. At the time, we didn't have the cell phones that we have today, so we actually have to go and see people. I need help. So that was the way we did it at that time. And it worked wonderful, you know, because you get a chance to sit and talk. So that's how I started being a lawyer. And then, from there on, I created my own law firm after that nonprofit. Now I got a job with an elected official, and I don't know what I'm doing still. But I'm doing whatever I need to do well. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Teresa. And I would say I'm just an ordinary person who had the opportunity in life to do some really extraordinary things that I never dreamed of or planned in my life. And things sort of just came my way and I was able to seize opportunities. So I'm an around the way girl. You know LL Cool J's song, I Just Want, who can sing an around the way girl? So I grew up in Hollis, Queens. Three blocks from LL, three blocks from Run DMC. Around the way girls, it means something. This hip hop language has really significant wisdom in it. And it really means something in terms of our identity, how we show up in the world. So I'm an around-the-way girl. And as I had the opportunity to go to university, I studied to be a journalist. And I was a journalist, and I was a damn good journalist. And then that profession betrayed me. I felt betrayed. As an around-the-way girl, there's something wrong with the way our images are being shown on television. And I have the power to change it. And ultimately, I realized I do not have the power to change it. So that pivotal moment came in 1992. I worked at CNN. I was in charge of producing the news. And Rodney King got his ass whooped. I know I'm sorry, you can cut that out. In front of me and a whole room full of journalists, and I saw social injustice, and everybody else saw a gorilla being beaten to an inch of his life. People who I worked with and who reported to me. And I really had no idea what I was going to do with that. I, for the first time in my life, I'm like, I really don't know what to do with this. So when you are faced with something like that, you have to make a decision. You either change it, you either live with it, or you leave it. I decided to leave it. I walked away from a really high-paying job with a lot of power, and I was gone. Told my friends, family, I'm going to Africa, and I'm never coming back. And that's what I did. Through a fellowship, which you guys really need to look into fellowships. Somebody's going to give you a plane ticket and go do whatever you're going to figure out to do. And I never came back. Until a few months ago, when I met Professor Joyce Moy and Claire, trying to figure out how to be an American after rejecting my Americanism for about 25 years. So I am what you call a humanitarian worker. We get lots of different labels, but a humanitarian worker is a person who saves lives, reduces suffering. You can do that in any number of ways you want, but I worked Myra. World Vision is part of the pack of humanitarians. You go around, you reduce suffering, you save lives. And I would say, at the time, there was no university that was going to teach you how to do that. So as I rose through the ranks of management, I realized I'm seasoned. And then I have a responsibility to prepare the next cadre of humanitarians who are coming through here to figure out what are they getting themselves into. You cannot go to college and learn how to be a humanitarian. You can learn humanitarian principle, practice, you can learn theory, you can learn a lot of things. But two things you absolutely have to do, you have to learn about yourself and learn about the context in which you work. Anything short of that, you get yourself killed. So I didn't leave the profession, but I left Africa because I have a teenage daughter who just wants no part of that life anymore. She wants to be where you are. She wants to be a college student in New York City. I'm like, oh my God. I have no idea what that looks like. And nobody's going to pay me to be in New York as an African specialist running programs, projects, and building capacity. But guess what? It's over. Packed up, left, came back to New York. No apartment, no job, no money, no mama, no man, no nothing. But that kid had decided, this, it's my life. And I want the life of a New York City. And I was like, okay. And it's done. So here we are. And I mean, I would have to thank my daughter for that because it's, even though I've had a really rich, and it has been extraordinary against what people in my neighborhood grew up to do. Being here gives me an opportunity to connect with leaders like Professor Moy, the panelists, and yourselves. Opportunities exist in Africa where I was, but nothing looks like this. So coming home gives you access to a set of resources that you absolutely must take advantage of while you go out and become a universal, you know, global citizen. Everywhere you are, you take advantage of the resources that are put in front of you. So I hope that you remember this day, not just because of us, but because of you. And you're in the right place at the right time. Thank you.
Thank you. So we did have a phone call to prep for this this session as panelists together. And, you know, I'm going to take like 30 seconds to prep you as an audience. You've heard the introductions, and a couple of things jumped out at me, and I'm wondering if you're hearing it as well. There's a lot of humility in these stories. These women are talking about not knowing what they've been doing, not having resources, being lost, feeling alone. There's a lot of humility here. But layered on that, or under that, is a lot of power. These women had power, used their power to overcome whatever obstacles and challenges they had. They talked about humanitarian causes. And they talked about being human. We are women, but I think we're humans first. So think about this in the context, especially in the context of what is being reported in the media, social media, everything else. Think in terms of the humanity that lives in each and every one. So I know you're listening very intently. Many of you are taking notes. That's wonderful. But listen with an ear for what is not being said. I'm going to ask, we benefited as a panel from your questions that you submitted and the things that you want to hear and learn about. So thank you for that. We're going to address some of those topics that sort of floated up to the top. We won't have time to talk about everything that you asked for during this panel, but we're going to address something called unpredictability, and life is not a straight path. We're going to talk about mentoring and the need and the strength and the value of finding mentors and what that actually means and building a strong network and what that actually means. And then also we're going to be talking about something that I believe and a lot of other people believe is absolutely fundamental to any kind of leadership, whether it's in corporate America, whether it's in politics, whether it's in nonprofit. It's about knowing who you are. Self-awareness is absolutely fundamental to being a good parent, to being a good person. Know who you are and what you really want to achieve. When I was growing up, we talked about a compass, a personal, moral, and value compass. Don't lose that. Keep it with you at all times. And so I'm going to start with Myra. You've heard a little bit about her story, and she's going to tell you a little bit more about the twists and turns, and not only that, that have happened in her life, but also what she's learned and how she's grown from them. Thank you, Myra.
So, I started in college. I told you I grew up in a advocacy home and a home of community and a lot of politics. So when I was in college, the last thing I wanted to do was politics. So I was like, I'm not going to do political science. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I didn't want to do that. So I kind of chased around everything. I tried all types of courses, and I didn't like any of them. None of them spoke to me. And then I took this one course, and it was actually about the judicial system and how we determine who stays and goes in a jail, which I thought was interesting. The woman that was doing it was just so amazing and challenged us. It's like, okay, you have a man that assaulted a woman and an older woman and beat her, and she's alive, but he's in jail. And there's a man that, you know, murdered someone, but there's not enough room. One of them has to go. Which one do you let go? And having those types of conversations. Anyway, after that class, I was like, fine. Political science it is. I'll go that way. That was the one thing that I didn't hate. And I was like, I was good at it. And I was like, okay. Although the practice and what's in the books are two different things, although you need them both, they're very important. So I went to political science. I mentioned I ran for district leader. I went to World Vision because I did internships. Super important, guys. You gotta do internships. So I wanted to be a lawyer, which is I touched on before. I wanted to go to law school because I loved just kind of debating things. And, you know, my father always said, you gotta be a lawyer because you don't stop. So, I did four internships, three at the Manhattan DA and one with a judge. One of my internships, I got to meet Tupac Shakur, which was, you know, really exciting. And I was looking for a paralegal job before I went to law school, and there was no paralegal jobs available at the time. And I had relationships, right? Because I had already spent 4 years in my MBA, which is not so easy to do while still in school. And I got a job at World Vision. And I liked what I was doing. 6 months into it, I got a call from my MBA saying, hey, we have a paralegal job if you're available. And I was like, I want to stay. I like what I'm doing. And my father was like, my girl, it's not about the money. It's about the opportunity. And I'm like, I know that, but it's not about the money. It's about the opportunity. Like what I'm doing here. I like what this organization stands for, and I went into it. I had a chance to go to Africa. It was amazing. I learned in Africa that one grain of sand makes the difference, right? And how rich you are, no matter how poor you may feel. So that was a great experience. But I stayed there too long. So as I was studying for my LSATs, I married my high school sweetheart. First year into marriage, we decide to have a baby, and my LSAT lands on the same date as my labor, you know? So I was like, ooh, do I take the chance? Do I take my LSAT? What if it lands on the same date? So I was like, I said, I'm going to push it back 6 months. Within those 6 months, I end up having a baby, getting separated, and being a single mom with a nonprofit job and a two-bedroom apartment. What am I to do? Law school, back burner. So I couldn't afford going to law school. I didn't have the time or support to be able to do that with a newborn. And I had to put that there. Now, I say this more than anything because life happens. And you never know what happens, and you go, and amazing things happened after that. But I want to tell you right now, whatever you want to do, don't wait too long. you know, if I should have just either done to do my master's or went to law school right away, not waited too long. I got engaged in a job that was very fruitful, but I waited too long and then life happens and there's other decisions that are more important at the time. It doesn't mean you still can't do that. I ended up as a single mom for 3 years. I started my own company and I had an opportunity and I got a job with Con Edison and they wanted a consultant to do community and government relations. And I was like, well, if I'm gonna do consulting for them, why not open a company? So I'm gonna do it as the company. So I told my dad and he says, Maya, why don't you just try this out and then see before? And I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna do it, I'll come back. So I was like, do you like this name, Maylin? And he's like, what's the name Maylin? This is gonna be my new company, the Maylin Group. And he's like, what is this? I'm like, I did it, I'm gonna do it. He was like, okay, later on, he was like, oh, thank God you didn't listen to me. Because, you know, you had this client, World Vision was my client for many years, Con Edison. I had other smaller groups, and I got to learn how to read blueprints and I had hard hat at the daytime to tell them to tighten up the plates because people were calling to complain, and then in the evening go into Yonkers chambers and tell them why we were doing whatever project. So that was exciting. Then I had a job at the governor's office, and then I ran for office. So you never know where life takes you, and all that. I remarried. I have this wonderful new husband. I have 2 new children. But I think that one of the biggest challenges now is being a mom, you know, and being able to do all of those things. And I wrote notes because it's like you deal with guilt, you know, like, how do I balance late nights, right? Like, okay, this week I had 3 late nights. 3 nights that my children were sleeping before I got home, and 2 days to pick them up and try to do a little bit of homework or something. You know, so you pick and choose what that looks like. And then trying to find a balance. And you're competing with other people in the world. So I just want to say, you never know where your path goes. The one thing I will say is that I have this linger, and you touched it, Mercedes, about like wanting to go back to school, like something's missing. And I've done a lot. I've enriched my life that I feel like, you know, I may not have a master's right now, but let me tell you, I've had a lot of great experience that helped me bring a lot to wherever it is that I go. But going back is definitely something that was my last one, which is a year old. As big enough, I'm gonna go back, even if it means just one class per semester. It's okay, it's no rush, you know, and I just take my time and do it. But I wish I would have taken advantage earlier, which is why I'm saying this to all of you. But it doesn't matter, you can keep growing, and sometimes you're gonna have challenges in life. But let me tell you, they make you stronger. I started the company because I felt that it was important and I needed to provide for my daughter. You don't think about it, but the same way you say you want the 7 train, I had to buy milk on a credit card, on a Macy's credit card. Did that make sense, you guys? Did you know the APR rate on that stuff? Oh, man, on a Macy's credit card. I mean, it took me forever to pay it back. But, you know, I had enough money to pay my rent, and I had to buy milk and diapers on a credit card to survive. And that, you know, those are challenges that just make you stronger for the future. So, anyway. I just wanted to share that.
Thank you very much. Every one of our panelists have had a life of unpredictability and challenges that they didn't expect they would have to meet. So is there something specific that you'd like to expand on or add or emphasize on, please, around unpredictability and the challenges?
Well, let's see. How to deal with life, right? It's so hard. I'm sorry. Yeah. I remember when we finally were able to get married, and we started preparing my wife and I for our wedding. And I went to the doctor, and you know, they said these things that things people tell you things, and sometimes you were like, what? And I went to the doctor. We were picking up the flowers first. We were picking up the flowers that day for the wedding. Our daughter was there. She was doing the picking. My wife, what she wanted it. And then I get a call from the doctor saying, you need to come in. I go like, what? He's about 2 blocks from my office. You need to come in. And I go to the doctor and I said, why? I said, we're very busy. He says, you have cancer. I go like, are you talking to me?
He said, yes, you have cancer. I said, where? Nothing hurts. And kidney cancer. And it doesn't hurt. It only hurts when it hurts, you're dying. So that was like, you know, what do I do from here? And, you know, trying to get back to picking up the flowers. Let me tell you, no flowers and no color that day. And that was one thing that really hit us, like, hard. And my wife and I, like, we're not having a wedding ceremony. We're not having a wedding party. And my daughter said, no, we're having a wedding party. And I tell you, it was a great party. And then, I mean, that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And then this year, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. And when we went to hospitals and doctors and everybody to ask them, so what do you do after you have your breast removed? They said, in America, in the United States, you've got to go through the standard of care. What is the standard of care? Chemo, like crazy, pills, drugs, and everything that you've got to do. You know what we did? We went to Cuba. Mm-hmm. We went to Cuba. And then we had conferences with doctors in Germany. We were looking for alternatives. What is standard of care? Every chemotherapy is like $25,000. That's the standard of care. Anyway, she didn't have the chemo. We have doctors in Cuba that are supporting us. Hopefully everything will be okay. We don't know if that type of breast cancer is it's a hormonal type of cancer. So anything could come back. So today, we are very grateful every day that we get up and we do things. And I said to her, honey, what is it that you always wanted to do? She says, I wanted to build our summer home. I says, where? She says, back home. I says, go and do it. Go and do it. And you know, it's incredible how sickness and these things really make you realize, I want to do what I want to do today. I want to do it well. Because I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Unpredictability. That's what life is all about. You know, so that's my little share on that.
Thank you. Thank you both. We're sharing some very personal stories here. There's a lot of candidness and openness and transparency. Many of you are kind of just just prejudgment, but many of you are young, most of you are young, and maybe before getting married, settling down, having family responsibilities, and before even really thinking about failing health or things that could happen around that. So, talking about unpredictability and how you deal with it, Mercedes and Mara talked about their support. Where did they get their support? How did they build networks to help them through tough times and build on the good ones? And this is something that Aylin does. She lives it, she works it, and she teaches it. So we're going to ask her to talk about mentoring and how you build networks and before you actually leave them.
Okay, so I think we think about mentorship and we think about networks. So let's start with networks, right? The notion of network. Sometimes, to many of us, myself included, the act of networking feels icky, right? It feels like, I gotta go, I gotta do some stuff, say some things, shake some hands, cool, right? It feels like a transaction. And then mentoring feels like, it feels like you're putting yourself out there. Is somebody gonna wanna be my mentor? Right? Is somebody going to want to invest that kind of time and energy into my growth? Right? So now let's flip it. I think it's important for you to realize you already have a network. Right? The network you currently have is rich and abundant with social capital. And so what is this notion of social capital? I think it's really important for us to think about because it's something that really ought to move you in understanding what you need and what are the supports that you need. I think it's very rare for any of us to have one mentor that is everything to us, right? Because if you think about just your daily life, you might go to a best friend for one thing, you might go to your family for another thing, you might go to your neighbor for something else entirely. That is your network of support, and that is how social capital kind of emerges, right? And social capital is defined as the accumulation of resources and knowledge through your relationships, right? And so you already have these relationships, and you're already exchanging on them daily. And if you think about it in kind of for yourself, and thinking about what you need for your growth, and then thinking about you already have it, you also have the ability to give, right? And so I think, especially for the talents that you bring to the table, understand what you can also give. Because the more you give, the more you learn about yourself. And the more you learn about yourself, you better understand how you want to ask for help, right? And how you continue to nurture the social capital that you need, right, to show up in the world. How do you socially locate yourself to understand the changes that you want to make in the world? Or for yourself, or for your communities, or for your families, right? And so the self-awareness piece comes in, and I think if you think about the social capital that's in this room right now, it is amazing. It's amazing what you can learn from somebody who's just sitting across the, you know, across the way. Maybe they're from a different campus and you haven't yet met them, right? And today is going to be a chance that you get to meet them. So it's not just us sitting up here, right? It is really about you and the power that you have to show up in the world and say, you know, this is what I need from a mentor, and this is how I'm going to go about it. And there's a lot of, you know, I think when we work with our young people and our students, we think about the breaking away from this transactional piece, right? And so don't lead with what can you do for me. Lead with how can I help you. Right? Because you have so much to give. And also be conscious of when are you giving too much? Because we have the tendency to give and give and give, right? Until we're fully expended. And it's important to be aware, what is your threshold? Right? So it keeps coming back. It's all about you, right? It's like a self-centered approach to giving, if that makes any sense. It feels like an oxymoron in some ways, right? But what enriches you? Right? What fuels you, what powers you, but by doing that, it enables you to give back. It helps you kind of build your community, helps you kind of support. So I think when we think about mentorship and we think about networks and we think about social capital, we start with ourselves and we say, how do I realize how I can help somebody else? Right? What is the give that I can, do? Right? Because then it becomes less of a transaction. It becomes a mindset. It becomes something that you feel empowered by, right? And so I think, and try if you can. And it's hard, right? You got to put yourself out there. I mean, I put myself out there plenty of times when mentors are like, I don't know about you. And that's okay, right? And that's okay. Kind of brush it off and keep going. But I think you should have a purpose in mind. When you're trying, I think, you don't always have to have a clear purpose, right? In the sense, like, I need this from you. That's not what I mean. I think it's like, well, what about this relationship can sustain itself? What about me and my contribution to this relationship can sustain, and what, how can I build it, and how can they build it back for me, right? And so it's about the give and take. Don't let the predominant notions of networking, that transaction, and some predominant kind of definitions of mentoring change the fact that you can contribute as well. Because that's really where the power lies in the entire kind of concept of mentoring and networking and social capital.
Thank you very much, Alan. Just a quick question. How many of you think that you are introverts? How many of you?
I don't really know what that means or why I'm even asking.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Alan made a very, very great point that understanding who you are and not only what you can give, but how much of it you have to give and what it takes to fill that well back up. We're going to ask Teresa to talk about self-awareness, understanding who you are, and building confidence from that base.
Okay, so this is a really big, messy, layered, complex topic. Identity, who you are, how you're supposed to show up in the world. people get PhDs on this. I mean, these philosophers from the beginning of time, ancients like Plato, all the way to modern day psychologists, to help us grapple with that question: who am I, and how am I supposed to show up in this world? You don't know, but you figure it out over time. Identity is so layered, right? You have national identities, you have gender identity, you have cultural identity, you have all kinds of identities. But if you really look down at your personal identity, it's really a concept of self, a concept that you develop about yourself. It evolves over time, over the span of your life. And I'm emphasizing the you, the your, and yourself. Not your grandmother, not your mother, not your boyfriend, not your boss. I'm emphasizing you. And collective identity is really important. The sense of belonging, sense of pride that you get from your groups, right? I'm very, very much wedded to my neighborhood that I grew up, and I haven't lived there for decades. But I'm so fiercely loyal to it. It's astounding. You can tell by my dance moves. When I get a dance, you know I'm from Harlem, right? So it's amazing who I am at my core. And I've been to over 100 countries. But that is who I've decided that I am. So again, your personal identity, concept defined by you, about yourself, evolves. It changes. Evolves over time based on however you decide you want to be. But there are some things that are really core. And that's what you have to understand about yourself. What is core to who I am and what I am? And it happens long before you even develop a self-awareness about that you have fingers or, you know, here. It's something that is really deeply inside of you. And getting to know that could probably be the hardest part of your journey. Getting a job is, I mean, you know, you get a job. You can make some money. You can have a profession. But getting to really know what and being real comfortable with it is a journey. So I'm going to just say a quick story. Who, everybody know who's getting married? Who's marrying Prince Harry? What's her name?
Megan.
Okay, so all of you know, this is a Megan story. Megan is all over the news. I don't pay attention to celebrity news. Coming from an African perspective, celebrities really don't have a part in my life. But I listened to this young woman speak about a defining moment in her identity. She talked about a time when she was a young woman, and she had to fill out some sort of census or some survey. And the first question asked her to identify herself, white, black, there was no other in Hispanic. And I think the other was added to a recent census, since I've been out of country. Because there was no other when I was growing up either. As a mixed race child, she didn't know what to put. And the teacher who saw her struggling said, fill in Caucasian. And she asked why. And the teacher said, because that's how you look. So she left it blank. She was traumatized by the encounter. She went home and told her father, who was white. And her father, who's a quiet man, said, the next time someone asks you to fill in a box that you don't fit in, draw your own box. Did this young woman know she was going to be a princess? No, it doesn't matter. You are not your circumstances. You are not homeless. You are not, you know, on a plane or at the UN. You're not your circumstances. You are who you are at your core. And you have to get really comfortable with that. So and live with the consequences of being who you are. So I am an extrovert. I've taken lots of personality tests. As a humanitarian, you have to take a lot of psychology tests. Make sure you're not crazy. Get yourself blown up. And you have to take personality tests because you're dealing with diverse teams. You have to know which people are going to respond to your particular style well. So as an extreme extrovert, my personality tests call me the challenger slash champion. And that comes with a whole set of characteristics that some I developed, but some, most of them are just inbred. And it led me on a path where I align those characteristics with my professional choices. It didn't mean that I was always accepted for being who I am. Like I said, there are consequences. A challenger champion is also called a bitch. And you got to get really comfortable with what other people are going to call you. I was like, okay, I'll be that, but I'm not going to be a rape victim. I'm not going to be somebody who betrays the most vulnerable people on the face of the earth by entering into some game of corruption. I'm not going to be that. If you want to call me that thing, I can live with that. But there's something at my core, my purpose, my passion, that eventually lines up. And in my case, it lined up to a nice paycheck. But that is not what these things will put in me for. You're not an accident, right? If you're an extreme introvert and you like to be by yourself, it doesn't mean you can't have a successful career as a humanitarian. You just have to understand who you are and your values, what's important to you, and be that and be comfortable with that, because that's who you really meant to be, and align your purpose, your passion, your personality up with your paycheck, whatever that looks like. So you seem to be introverted, right? You're in the humanitarian sector like me, so they call us the cowboys. You know what we are. Jump out of a plane, you get it popping. You have to save lives and reduce suffering, and anybody who gets in your way, including Kofi Annan from the UN, you have to move, because I have something I have to do. I was born to do this. And he was born to do what he does. And there's a place for all of us. Nothing wrong with you, not a mistake. You're meant to be who you are. Get to know what that is. And it's not what your dad says, your mom says, your husband says. You have to get comfortable with who you are and apply that to its fullest in how you're going to show up in the world. And it doesn't mean you have to have a big, fancy, you know, celebrity career. But you can contribute. And you do contribute. You wouldn't be sitting here if somebody didn't see you as a contributor to the world, right? Just go out and contribute, and you don't know what it's going to look like. When I was growing up, we had real definitions of who we were based on the neighborhood we came from. There were no white rappers when I was coming up. There was no such thing. And then Eminem came up. I'm like, what is that? And he said, there's no white rapper. But I am a white rapper. And we're like, okay, well, well, then, as long as you're good at what you do, you don't embarrass us. But did he say, did he live up to the world's definition of who he was? No. Is he a happy-go-lucky guy who's enjoying his wealth? This man is angry and unhappy. But that is who he is. And that is who he's supposed to be. And he figured out how to cut a path that didn't exist. And he is true to himself. Not everybody likes it. Too bad. Get over it. He has changed his world with whatever talent that he has. I changed the world with whatever I know how to do. Big mouth, big hands, big hair. Get it. And I know that not everybody is comfortable with it, but I have a purpose, I have a passion, and I'm supposed to have it. So figure it out. And again, one last thing. In terms of your identity, don't ever confuse extroversion, noisy extroverts, with leadership. This country is led by a noisy extrovert. He's a lot of other things, but that's what he is. You can be a noisy extrovert and be empty. You can be a very deep introvert. My daughter is a deep introvert. I take my leadership cues from her in many cases. So who you are is not a mistake. Who you are doesn't have to fit into any cultural identity, national identity, gender identity. Be who you are. Your value system. Are you courageous? Are you compassionate? Are you, you know, introspective? Whatever it is you are, those value systems, embrace them and nurture them, because that's exactly who you're supposed to be. So that's all I want to say about identity for now. When we get into our smaller group, we'll speak more about identity and what that means. But all of you, just give yourself a hug. There's the DNA running through your body. By the way, I'm 12% Asian. Didn't know it until that's what Geographic told me. It was a shock.
Some people
what?
Might say that's the better part.
Right, yeah, exactly. And my father's a Cherokee Indian. So where did the Asian Cherokees are indigenous to Mongolians in Mongolia. They're indigenous to Mongolia. And they're indigenous people, but just not indigenous to the United States. I had no idea what I even had running through my veins.
Teresa's absolutely right.
Right.
There's a lot going on, and we have more to the program.
Right.
So. Thank you very much. I wanted to summarize what she said because it's so important, is understanding your core and aligning it with that quote-unquote called brand. I know in career development, a lot of people talk about your personal brand and developing and growing your personal brand, but whatever that brand turns out to be, and sometimes that brand is assigned to you, but if you're going to build a personal brand, make sure that your core values are at the core of it. I'm going to ask Joyce to come back up here and introduce us into the next segment of our program. We have a lot more to go. So a round of applause for our wonderful panelists.
Thank you. I have to say this really was wonderful, eye-opening, emotional for me. I know two of you quite well, and I've gotten to know two more well, and I feel really privileged to be with you. I say that as a mom. I say that as a woman. I say that as a teacher. I've learned so much. You know, you're not alone. So the next portion of this program, we had wanted to have you sit at a particular table to which you're going to be assigned, and you will be sitting and speaking with our wonderful leading women here. And what we're going to do is to ask you to think of a word that describes you. And then think of a context that makes you describe yourself that way. What has happened in your life, for example, that has caused you to describe yourself that way? And then think about three characteristics that you have that you try to, that helps to illuminate why that word describes you. Then we're going to have you turn to someone that you're sitting with and talk about yourself for a couple of minutes. And then they're going to think about you, and they're going to jot down three characteristics that they observed as they spoke, as they heard you speak. Then you will turn to another person, and you will then play the role of a listener, and your former listener will then tell you about herself. And again, you would jot down three characteristics that you observed as she spoke. And then we're going to go around your table, and you're going to tell people how you identified yourself, and look at what other person's impressions of you were. It's just a way of learning about yourself. It's a way of learning to speak up. So I'm going to ask you to just sit for a second, think of a word that describes yourself, think about what makes you think that. What happened? Was there a particular experience? And then jot down the three characteristics, and in a couple seconds, Claire will be back up here with a little card for each of you that will indicate whose table you're going to be sitting at, and then we'll begin the exercise. Okay, I'm going to give you 3 to 5 minutes to jot down your descriptive word and three of your characteristics. Okay?